session number 17365, Reel 2.
Mr. Waddington, Reel 2.
Yes, so nobody got any leave. I remember one fella called Jack Paul, who had a very unfortunate time. Because he was a pilot, and he came from Coventry. And I think it was, we didn't all fly out on the same night. Jack Paul, his navigator was Jack Williams, who I've already mentioned. And he got special leave. He didn't go out with the first lot, but he got special leave because of the bombing of Coventry. And I can't really remember, but I'm not quite sure if it wasn't a fact that his parents were killed. I really can't remember that, but it was very sad. And they didn't come out. He perhaps had quite a bit of leave. Maybe the house was bombed or something like this. But they didn't come out till after Christmas. After Christmas, it was before they came. So anyway, it was... I well remember the night that we left for Malta because it was dark. I think we took off somewhere, you know, maybe 9 o'clock or something like that. And I felt, I'd watched the sun go down that day, and I felt very, very homesick. I thought, oh dear, I'm going away. When will I come back and see everybody? I'd still got this girl in Cottingham. I was worried about her, about leaving her, and about leaving England, really. But we soon got over that, really. We flew out to Malta and found it, which was quite pleasing, really. We flew over France to somewhere near Marseille, and then to Sardinia, I think it was, and then east from there, and landed at Malta, Lucca Airport, Malta, at somewhere about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. It was much warmer there, of course, having left England in November. We stayed in Malta. I forget how many crews would be there. That might have been about 6 crews. We stayed in Malta for about 2 weeks. We were able to look around it and make the best of it. Went down the gut where all the dirty women were and saw the most extraordinary things happening.
What sort of things?
Not to be mentioned. Not to mention here. as my name's on this, I won't mention it, but not only naked women, but doing things. I don't mean fornicating. So I think whilst we were there, one thing I remember about Malta, it's very white, and the sun used to absolutely blind you on this. All the buildings seem to be white, and there's a lot of chalk, perhaps, or something. But whilst we were there, we did 2 operations. We flew twice to Italy. Once to bomb the fleet, which was in Taranto. And another time, I think we went to a place called Bari, B-A-R-Y. But I can't remember whether it was an aerodrome or what, or a town or what. But we only did the 2 operations there in the fortnight.
How did those operations compare with the ones you'd been doing from Norfolk?
It was more enjoyable in that the opposition wasn't as strong. I don't think the Italians had quite the fighting spirit of the Germans, really, if they don't mind me saying so. Bombing the fleet, which must be very heavily armed, at a very low height, perhaps 3,000 or 4,000, and I think we flew over twice. Barry, I can't remember anything about it at all. It's gone right out of my mind. And then suddenly, after about a fortnight, we went to Egypt. A daytime flight. There didn't seem to be anything dangerous about that in those days. You'd got to look out for British ships,
course they fired on everything, at everything. I don't blame them really. And we landed in to a place called Cabrit, which is on the Great Bitter Lakes, which is in the Great Bitter Lakes are between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. The canal links the Great Bitter Lake with the Red Sea. Cabrit. It was still, it might have been December by then, and it was absolutely marvellous because the sun was hot. We were in our swimming suits, swimming in the Great Bitter Lake and sunbathing, and I suppose really it was quite a treat. It was quite a treat, really.
Your logbook actually says you arrived on the 25th of November at Cabrit.
Ah, right. Yes, right. Now, whether we did any... I think we did some operations from there. It was at the time... pardon me. The... just a minute, I'll just have a drink. It was at the time when we were giving the Italians a pasting in the desert. They'd had the audacity to attack from Libya, I suppose it was, into Egypt, and advanced quite a long way, and then our army attacked them, and we took a huge amount of prisoners, I think 30,000 or something, and gradually over the next few months we drove them right back through Tobruk, Derna, and as far as Benghazi and beyond. Now,
what was the role of 37 Squadron in all that?
Now, 37 Squadron was bombing them, and this was quite an enjoyable period. To bomb Benghazi, it was quite a long way, so we used to fly out during the day, used to fly to into the Western Desert. It was called, it didn't have a name, it was called LG9 or something, Landing Ground 9 or Landing Ground some number. And there'd be some poor Irks there with petrol and rations and tents. And we'd refuel there, and depending, we maybe wouldn't be taking off for 3 or 4 hours until it was dark or something like this, and you'd just hang about really then and do nothing in particular. One thing I remember about the Western Desert, which I'll never forget, it's the only time in my life ever that I've known absolute silence. It was so quiet, you could hear it in a way. Occasionally you would hear some distant thunder, but at night particularly, it was kind of eerie. All you could hear were noises in your ear. So anyway, we would refuel and bomb up, I suppose. I mean, the bomb, we wouldn't have flown out there with the bombs because you didn't land with bombs on. And then we would set off, and we used to bomb places like Tobruk, Derna, Benghazi. And really, this was quite enjoyable, but I can certainly remember at Benghazi, when we got there and started bombing, I mean, I think all the Italians went into the shelter, I think, because the anti-aircraft fire just stopped. And we used to bomb them at low level, you know, by that I mean 3,000, 2,000 feet, and just bombing the buildings or any aircraft that were about. You know, I think we wouldn't over just go over the target once. We'd just drop some bombs, a few bombs, and come round and go over again, which we never ever did in Germany. You just wanted to get rid of them as quickly as you could. So really, from that point of view, life was fairly enjoyable. You couldn't, of course, get over the fact that you were a long way from home. You'd got your mummy and you'd got your girlfriend and all your other friends. I was very, very pally with my brother, and he was still at home. But I suppose you made the best of it. The mail was always a problem because it used to take
many weeks to get letters back from there to there. So Christmas came, and quite a lot of us, well, perhaps we all got Christmas leave. And I went with a gang of about another five or six of us to Cairo. Never been to Cairo before. And we stopped in quite a nice hotel and had a very nice few days there. We went to church on Christmas morning and sang "Oh Come All Ye Faithful" and all the usual English hymns. It must have been the English cathedral. And that was, that made you feel very homesick, did that. Then in the afternoon, we went out, must have gone out in a taxi, to the pyramids, which, I don't know, about 15, 20 miles away, the pyramids of King Cheops, C-H-E-O-P-S, I think it's spelled, and that's where the Sphinx is. So we hired camels and rode around on camels, and of course, you're not supposed to call them wogs, but we call them wogs in those days. I mean, they're all the time begging and trying to get money from you. We went in. You can go into the very big pyramid, into the biggest pyramid, because right in the very, very centre of it is the burial chamber where, I suppose, King Cheops must have been buried. But everything that's in it has been removed. It's perhaps in the London Museum now or somewhere. But you had to go up all these hundreds and hundreds of steps. It was quite sort of claustrophobic, really. And the rotten old wogs, I mean, he would keep putting the light out, and you had to, to give him some more money if you wanted him to put the light on. Terrible people. So that was that. I don't know really what else we did. We would go out. I think I went to the pictures once. We had been told that when they played the national anthem, we had to stand to attention, and it used to go up you shoot, King Farouk, hang your bollocks on the hook, up you shoot, something like that it went. Those are our words, not theirs. We went out for meals and did shopping, and I think that was a leave. Lasted about 4 days. Spent about a month's pay, I suppose. You couldn't have anything to do with the girls there. They just didn't want to know you. You were just troops. There was one fellow who got friendly with a girl, but she wouldn't walk with him in the street. He had to walk behind her. They were quite nice-looking girls, of course, being Egyptians. The noise of the place is a thing I remember. They're all the time blowing horns in the street, all the time, for no reason at all. The noise is absolutely terrific. So then we went back to... I don't know really if we'd moved from Cabrit. I think we'd moved by then to Fayad, F-A-Y-I-D, I think it's spelled. We moved, twice we moved, once to Fayad, which was a terrible place. We were then in tents, whereas at Cabrit we'd been in proper building, wooden buildings. Fayad was just a short stop. Then we went to a brand new aerodrome called Shaloufa, which was about 6 miles north of Suez. And that was where I spent the rest of my time in Egypt. It was... all this wretched sand, of course. I mean, we used to absolutely hate it, and the heat, and these sandstorms that used to blow. So we settled down at Shaloufa. I got, it must have been soon after Christmas, because Jack Williams hadn't arrived then. I'd got into a room. There were these barrack blocks that were, they were wooden, and at the end of it there was there were two rooms where the sergeants slept, in the huts, in the main part of the hut, were all the Irks. An Irk being anything below a corporal, I think. And I saved a bed in this room for Jack Williams, who eventually came. I was very, very pleased to see him.
So we continued operating from Shalova, flying up to the desert, bombing up and going to these places. And then some of the squadron went to, I don't know if it's Iraq or Iran, but there was a man called Rashid Ali who caused a revolution, and we had to put it down. He was backed by the Germans.
That was in Iraq?
It was in Iraq, was it? Right. It was backed. The Germans were trying to cause dissent there. Anyway, they sorted that out. And then, as if it wasn't bad enough, the Germans attacking everywhere, they attacked Greece. So some of the squadron went to Athens. I didn't go on the first lot. Jack Williams went. And they, in those days, we used to go bombing when the moon was up, not all the time, but, you know, perhaps for a fortnight. Whereas later on, you know, much, much later on, you only went when the moon was down, when it was pitch black. So Jack Williams went there, and they stayed perhaps a fortnight and then came back again. And then in the next month, the next moon, I went to Egypt. I don't know how many of us went. It wasn't all that comfortable there. We were in an aerodrome just outside Athens called Menidi. Some people called it Tatoi, and it seemed to have two names. From there, we used to bomb, and of course the weather wasn't very good then. It was getting on towards Easter time. And there was plenty of snow about, and it was cold, and you had to shave outside. It's not all that nice. We used to go into Athens, though, of course, and the girls were more friendly there. But I do remember a funeral we had there. The one of the planes going there had crashed landing or something, and there were six fellas killed, and so the RAF were very, very popular in Greece in those days because they were the only people who were trying to help them against the Germans. So we were real heroes. And on this funeral day, they put these coffins on open trucks, and we rode on the open trucks through the streets, which were packed with people watching this procession, if you could call it that. We got to this cemetery, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds of Greeks there and conducted this service. I think I was just in the sort of guard of honour. I don't remember doing anything in particular, but Jack Williams told me afterwards that he tripped up and fell in one of the graves, but he was a bit of a line shooter. I don't really know if that's true or not. So one or two crews were lost in there, that's for certain. And the places we bombed were Tirana in Yugoslavia, Sofia in Bulgaria, the docks at Durazzo, which is on the Adriatic, and one night we were told that Mussolini was stopping in a house, mind you, how can you find a house? Somewhere, and it was in the left wing, or the west wing, or something, and we had to go and bomb this house. As a matter of fact, I think we found the house, I can't imagine why. One or two planes were lost that night, I think. And to do this operation, we didn't take off from Medini and fly all the way. We had to go up and fly up further north in Greece, and we landed at a place with the lovely name of Paramythia. And it was covered in daffodils. This aerodrome, it was just grass and covered in daffodils, and it was amongst the mountains, so it was rather hazardous taking off.
Do any of those raids stick out in your mind apart from that one, such as the raids on Rhodes?
Yes, I went to Rhodes from Athens, but we also went to Rhodes from Egypt. Rhodes, yes. Rhodes is in the Dodecanese Islands, and it had been taken over by the Italians from the Greeks, I think, and there was an aerodrome there. I went to Greece three times, I think. Once or twice from Athens, and where it was not a very long way, and once or twice from Egypt. There was one particular time where we went from Egypt, and it was quite a long way. It was about, I think, at least 400 miles over the sea. And the two squadron leaders went. Yes. I think it was a Sunday, and it was organised that the two squadron leaders with their crews would go because they weren't all that sure about the weather over Rhodes Island. So they would report back by radio whether the rest of the squadron should go or not. And I think it was a Sunday, and because it got dark then, I think perhaps about 7 o'clock. So we took off on a Sunday afternoon, and it was probably three or four hours flight, I would think. And the whole of the journey was over the sea. But the first 100 miles, perhaps, were taken up by flying over the rest of Egypt till we got to the coast. So we were able to pinpoint the coast and get a fair idea of what the wind was. And it could have altered by the time we got to Rhodes, but it was daylight, and flying over the sea, we had a sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, but you'd find out the drift with this machine by picking up, by lying on your tummy and looking through the bomb window and picking up the drift. The drift being the angle between, I can't remember now, would it be the compass bearing and something. But anyway, you could tell a plane flying with the wind at its side has to turn into the wind. And so it's crabbing along. And this is what the drift is, really. It's the difference between where it's pointing and the direction it's going in. I think that's it, really. If the wind's coming from the starboard side, which is the right, this way, the pilot's got to turn that way to counteract the wind, which is blowing in that way, whilst it's pointing there, it's going there. So I took a drift sight and found that we had more drift or less drift than I thought we had. So we altered course, and that was really the best thing I did on that flight, really, because when we got to nearer to Rhodes Island, it was dusk, really. And the cloud, we'd run into the cloud, and we had to go beneath the cloud down to about 2,000 feet. And we fortunately hit Rhodes Island just about where we wanted to be. It was an absolute miracle. So we very soon found this aerodrome, which is called Lindos, and Lindos is used today by the holidaymakers who go to Rhodes Island. And we found this thing, and there were planes lying about, parked there, and so we bombed them. And now this is where Baird Smith was a good pilot. We didn't just drop the bombs and bugger off. We did four runs over. We just dropped a few at a time, and we did four runs over, and we were getting fired at all the time to start with, or perhaps all the time, I don't remember, but I know to do the bombing you had to lie down on your stomach and look down through the thing, and your bomb sight here and so forth. And, you know, I began to think about getting some bullets in my stomach. So I remember I drew my knees up and sort of sat on my knees whilst we did this. And we actually bombed very well indeed, in that we set a started quite a lot of fires and set them on fire. And then we, because of the bad weather, we wireless back to base, don't come, because we didn't think it was really fit, really. Most of them would perhaps never have found the place. The other squadron leader, who shall be nameless, he couldn't find their aerodrome, so he bombed our fires. And they wireless back to say, yes, come, it's all right. It didn't. So anyway, we went back and we flew back uneventually. And we didn't go back to, I don't know why we didn't go back to Shilu for that night, but we landed at a place in the desert to the west of the civilized part of Egypt. The west of Cairo was Shalufa, was to the east of Cairo. And we spent the night there in a hotel, on the floor, I think, actually. I don't know really why. I seem to remember sleeping on this hard floor. And took off the next morning and went back to Shalufa. And we found, to our surprise, that there were 27 bullet holes in the plane. A week or two went by, and they announced that Baird Smith had got a DFC for this operation. And it really never occurred to me that I might get a medal. I don't think it ever entered my head. But one Saturday morning, Wing Commander Collard, who was the squadron commander, called me into his office and said, "Oh, Waddington, pleased to tell you, you've got a DFM." And I didn't really know what to say to him. I think I just said, "Oh, thanks very much." And that was it. So that's how we got a DFM. That was Rhodes Island. Now, I think I've mentioned that we went to Greece twice. And both occasions, I think the second time, it was a month later, so the weather was improving. And in fact, we lived in tents then, which was a relief, really, because in this barrack block that we're in, it was just absolutely full of lice that used to creep up the bed legs and get in. And they're awful, awful things, terribly. Can't stop them biting you. The vermin. You could, I think, if you could find any tins or any paraffin, you could stand in the bed in tins with paraffin in. But one thing I do remember about that time, when we were still in the barracks as opposed to the tents, that there was an ammunition ship blew up in Piraeus Harbour. Piraeus is the harbour for Athens. And this, in the middle of the night, this tremendous explosion. I don't know, I've read somewhere why it blew up, but I can't remember now, but it was a devastating thing, and a whole ship full of ammunition blew up. By this time, the Germans were getting nearer, and we had to be very careful about air raids. I think that's why we were put out in the trees, in these tents, I think, really. Then, eventually, we flew back to Shalufa. And it wasn't really long after that. I think I only did one more trip. And then, having done 38 operations, I was taken off operations. That was one advantage about being in the Air Force as against the Army. I mean, if you were in the Army, you just went on fighting forever. In the Air Force, when you'd done about 30, you were...